Welcome, House Water Committee, this wonderful Friday, March 18th. We have still had a lack of water. We're still under an obligation to say a prayer on whatever or wherever you do that sort of thing for water. And we are at this point going to open a work session. And the first item on the agenda is HJM 10 from that work session. Staff.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HJM 10, you'll remember we heard on Monday, the 14th of March. This was the memorial that urges Congress to enact and the President to sign the Tsunami Preparedness Act. We heard testimony from our local coastal folks on how some of our communities are addressing it. They're taking action with multiple workshops and summits on how to do this, so our communities here in Oregon really would appreciate our support on supporting the federal act.
Okay. Yes. Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I move that the committee send House Joint Memorial 10 to the floor with a do accept recommendation.
Representative Barnhart moves that the committee send House Joint Memorial 10 to the floor with a do accept recommendation. Is there discussion? Hearing none, we'd call the roll, please.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Brown? Excuse. Representative Balto?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dingfelder?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Crummell?
Excuse.
Chair Jensen?
Aye. Having received a majority, House Joint Memorial 10 is referred to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. And Representative Barnhart, would you like to carry that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I wonder if Representative Roblin might want that one. If he doesn't, I'd be happy to carry it.
I've had no request from or anything.
Okay.
Well, Representative Dalton.
Mr. Chair, only if I may, Representative Roblin did present the bill for our consideration, just to throw that in there.
In response to that, then, we would assign Representative Roblin the bill to carry it on the floor. In the event that he would choose not to do that, Representative, would you accept that?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. So noted. And we'll close the work session then on HJM 10, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2522. Refresh our memory, if you would, Sandy, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, members of the committee, we had a public hearing on House Bill 2522 on Monday the 14th. As you recall, this was the bill that is requesting the city of the Dalles is requesting that we approve a fine increase from $100 to $1,250 at their request for trespass violation on their watershed zone. At that hearing, the committee had requested that we investigate if this measure should go to judish. Both myself and the chair have checked on that, and there does not appear to be any reason why this committee cannot address the issue of just increasing the fine. There's nothing else that would require judiciary to evaluate and discuss.
Thank you, Sandy. Yes, I talked to the chair of the judiciary, and they have some modest 400 bills to hear in there. Or to sort through, whether they hear them all or not is another question, to sort through, and it didn't disturb him that he might not have this particular bill. So,
Mr. Chair, I move that we send House Bill 2522 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Barnhart has moved House Bill 2522 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair, did this have a subsequent referral?
No.
Okay.
May I ask, is there anyone who will object to this? Thank you. Would you call the roll then, please?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Brown? Excused. Representative Dalton?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dingfelder? Excused. Chair Jensen?
Aye.
Vice Chair Crummell?
We're going to Okay. Having received the majority, House Bill 2522 is passed on to floor with a do-pass recommendation. In light of the fact that we are short in our majority number, that we have three members excused right now, the chair is going to ask if there's somebody that would like to carry House Bill 2522 rather than put it on a consent calendar.
Sure, I'd be willing to. If you think it's important to have it carried and not just put on the consent calendar,
well, I would put it on the consent calendar if we had a couple more members here voting yes on it, but with three people absent,
I
prefer not to.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Basel.
Perhaps to entertain a thought, we could place it on the consent calendar if you so desired and advise the other members if they had a concern with the bill. To alert the clerk, I think it only takes one member of our chamber to request that the bill be pulled off of the consent calendar, at which time you may wish to assign a carrier if that happened.
Yes, I appreciate, but I think we can do it pretty quickly, can't you, on carrying it. Let's carry it. And Representative Tomei will give us a very brief good bill should pass, and
I can do that, sir.
Yeah, sort of thing. Thank you. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2522, and we are down to a point on our informational meeting. And the informational hearing that we're having today is on the IMST report on the Coastal Coho Assessment Project report. And I see Mr. Gregory here to give us the highlights and the in-depth and detailed discussion of everything that we need to know or should not want to know about the IMST's report.
Thank you, Representative Jensen, and Chairman Jensen, and committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I will first of all indicate that I'm representing IMST, the co-chairs, Nancy Molina and Carl Schreck, could not be here today, so they asked me to represent the team. And I will be presenting an overview of a review that we just submitted to the state this morning, reviewing the Coastal Coho assessment. On December 17th, we received a request from Mike Carrier, in the Governor's Natural Resource Policy Director, asking the IMST to review the viability report within the Coastal Coho assessment. And then on February 1st, we received a subsequent request to review the PEACE document, the process for the evaluation of conservation efforts. And so we have worked with the state to review these documents and have submitted our review to Michael Carrier this morning on March 18th. I would, just for your information, let you know that we have been meeting with the state for a little bit less than a year now, but almost a year. Late last spring, early summer, we started meeting with the state. We were advised by the state that that they were conducting this assessment, and they wanted to coordinate with IMST right off the bat. And so in their early stages, as they started developing their assessment, they shared this with us at our monthly meetings. And we had probably, I don't have the exact number, but probably at least 5 to 7 meetings in which we met with their staff and discussed their approach, asked questions, received answers, made suggestions and comments. So this is a longer-term process than just the review over the last few weeks. And I think that that has been very constructive for both the IMST and the state in that aspect. We were asked to answer a few questions, so I'm going to briefly read at least the summary questions that were directed to us. If you turn in the document that we just provided of our review to page 1 in the introduction, so it's actually about, I think, 6 pages into the stack that you're looking at, but page 1 is the introduction in which we outline what this review covers. The comments that we provide are in response to a request from the Governor's Natural Resource Office to review these documents and provide feedback on whether the scientific approach and analysis are credible and consistent with accepted scientific standards, and whether the assumptions and uncertainties are reasonable and characterized accurately. And then we were also asked to provide any suggestions on ways we can improve our analysis with available data. In the viability assessment, we were given five specific components of the analysis to address. Number one, the determination of the ESU or the strata or the population structure. Number two, the attributes used to define viability and assess the fish status. Number three, the development of specific criteria for each attribute. Number four, development of specific criteria for the strata and the ESU as a whole. And then finally, the assessment of the current status of coastal coho relative to population, strata, and ESU viability criteria. So, that's long-winded, but I wanted you to know what we were charged to do and what this document represents. In general, we found the viability assessment to be scientifically credible. We want to emphasize that the IMST is reviewing this document in terms of the scientific credibility. We do not take a position on whether the determination of status is correct or incorrect. We remain neutral on that. It's the state's responsibility to determine, to make this assessment and to forward that assessment to NOAA Fisheries and then for the listing determination to be made. So we simply reviewed this in terms of the scientific credibility behind the assessment. So we have confined our review to matters of scientific rigor, the adequacy of evidence to support the assertions, and a clear logic track. So we found the viability assessment to be holistic and robust, and it constituted a thorough review of the viability criteria and the status of the Oregon Coho ESU. While the peace certainty analysis had some very good discussions of state policies and actions for salmonid protection, we felt that some of the statements about effectiveness were not adequately supported by data or analyses. And so we recognize that the authors of this document were given a very short period of time to produce one of the most complex analyses of coho that has been done in this state or this region, and we commend them for the high quality of their report. We want to point out what we think some of the particular strengths and weaknesses are. In particular, the major strengths are that the use of criteria, the major criteria for the viability analysis, those are abundance of salmon, the distribution of salmon, the productivity, the persistence, and diversity of salmon. We agree that these are scientifically appropriate and that they're consistent with criteria being used by NOAA in their TRT process. We concluded that the overall rigor and integration of the disciplines and variables and blending of modeling approaches with observed data was very strong, that the clarity of presentation and general logical development of conclusion was good. We commended the readability of the documents, especially in trying to take technical information and make it more readable. We made many suggestions on ways that we think that could be improved, but they did a major effort. As a matter of fact, just a side note, one of the comments we had for them is they briefed us on what they were trying to accomplish, and we said this is going to be a Herculean task of communication because it's very complex material on very contentious issues, and to communicate clearly about these complex issues in a complex process to a complex political and public arena. It was a task that no one should be assigned, but they bravely took it on and did a good job. We particularly point... Yes, sir.
You aren't suggesting that some of the people who might read this may have bring some preconceived biases to the whole process?
Chairman Jensen, certainly no one in this room, and mostly preconceived biases make no. I'm sure that would not be the case.
Okay.
But communicating this complex material is a challenge for anyone. We did particularly feel that the synthesis and discussion chapter in the viability assessment was particularly helpful and significantly enhanced the report's credibility, because there they discussed their uncertainties and risks and that was a real strength of the report. We also pointed out some areas that needed to be strengthened, that could be improved. And so we are identifying these, but we do want to stress, kind of before we get into any of this, that we do think that the viability assessment in particular, and this entire document, points to the value and the strength of the Oregon Plan and the monitoring program that was established in the Oregon Plan. That investment that the state has made in monitoring made this assessment possible. You will not see an assessment of COHO status by California or the state of Washington that could rival this. And that is because the state of Oregon, under the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, has committed to monitoring the status of salmon and providing the data that made this analysis possible. And so the very presence of this assessment is a tribute to the Oregon Plan. And so before we point out some of the needs to strengthen, we'd like to stress that this does represent a successful Oregon Plan in our opinion. All three of the documents that we reviewed, the viability assessment, the peace document, and then the synthesis or integration, would benefit from a more balanced presentation of the information, analyses, conclusions, and uncertainties. Quite often after the conclusions were presented, the reports tended to focus solely on the evidence and outcomes that supported those conclusions. And we think a more balanced presentation of some of the weaknesses and uncertainties, along with some of the strengths and evidence supporting it, would be a more credible, provide a more credible document. Many of the uncertainties are either largely dismissed or they are mentioned and then moved on. The conclusions may really remain the same in many cases, but some of the uncertainties or risks or the conclusions need to be clarified. And we can provide specifics within the review. One of the things that would be useful, the assessment comes to the conclusion that the recommendation of the state would be that coastal coho salmon stocks are viable. They meet the minimum criteria for viability. We feel that it would be helpful if the assessment clearly indicated the state's determination of the status of coastal coho salmon along the continuum from endangered to threatened to the minimum criteria of being viable or viability to recovered to healthy and robust. The state has conducted workshops and developed legislation about definitions of recovery under the Oregon Plan. We were asked to review this assessment within the framework of both the Endangered Species Act and the federal listing of coho salmon and the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, which sets higher standards than the simple risk of extinction and the viability of the stock. And so we feel that if this report made it more clear where the salmon stocks currently fall along that approximate continuum from endangered to healthy and robust, it would be more informative. We feel that the state has concluded that they meet the minimum levels of viability, but they're not fully recovered, healthy and robust to meet the goals of the Oregon Plan. So while they may meet the goals of the Endangered Species Act in terms of delisting, they may not meet the Oregon Plan goals for the salmon. In places, it's difficult to determine whether the authors are speculating or stating facts, and so in a few places, in several places, supporting.
Excuse me.
Yes, sir.
I'm trying to, digest a little bit of this as you're going through this, and I think I understood, what you're saying about some type of a continuum of from extinct to more than we know what to do with.
Correct.
For lack of more scientific jargon to throw in there, there's nothing I hope in this report that is going to indicate that the Oregon Plan is not still operable as far as the coastal coho are concerned. That is, that the basic idea of the Oregon Plan is still, at least it was my understanding, would still be in place. that we would still have a responsibility as a society to maintain the healthy streams sort of thing, that and that the department would still have a responsibility as far as the maintenance of some type of monitoring, managing, if you wish, but I guess that would be my word, managing of the population as such. Am I wrong in this, or am I off base in where this question is at?
Chairman Jensen and committee, you are correct that the assessment, the entire document, and our review underscore the need for the Oregon Plan and its full implementation, and that that's an ongoing process, and that if anything, it underscores as much as ever we need the Oregon Plan and its elements to accomplish what this document sets out to be the protection and maintenance of these stocks. It also points toward the several successes that need to be continued, such as the tremendous improvements in monitoring, the enormous changes in harvest management that have come about through the Oregon Plan, the changes in hatchery practices, that these changes made huge differences and are still needed to continue. Also, the watershed councils and the watershed practices of the state agencies are absolutely essential, and in some ways these remain our most they remain the challenges that we need to continue to address, the need for habitat in our watersheds. Many of the others we pointed out could be responded to fairly quickly due to the excellent improvements there have been made in harvest management. If we detect a trend in the stocks that is undesirable, we can change harvest fairly quickly. Even hatchery practices can be changed fairly quickly. But if we detect trends in the stocks that are related to habitat conditions that are not desired, then it's going to take much longer to change those conditions. And so the Oregon Plan is absolutely essential in all of those areas, but particularly in continuing to work on habitat issues. So it underscores the need for those. There, we, in reading it, felt that that needed to be emphasized so that anyone picking up the COHO assessment by the state of Oregon realized that this was both a recognition of the advances made by the Oregon Plan, but also the need for the continued operation of the Oregon Plan.
Thank you, Stan. Please proceed.
There are several critical assumptions in the viability assessment. They depend upon the evidence of the survival of coastal salmon through recent periods of low ocean productivity, the relationship between the production of pre-harvest adults per spawner at different densities of spawners, the analysis of risk of extinction based on a Ricker model of population dynamics of salmon. We think the report would be strengthened by a more balanced discussion of the strengths and weaknesses of these very critical lines of evidence in the report. The COHO assessment also relied heavily on a new low abundance paradigm, as it was stated in the assessment that we reviewed. This perspective on coastal coho salmon has not been thoroughly reviewed or tested, and so the state should be cautious in making decisions that are based heavily on the new low abundance paradigm and should seek additional intensive review. Within the document, we had actually, it's not contained in these overview bullets, but in the document, we pointed out that the IMST would be willing to assist in that kind of intensive review or workshop of that new paradigm if the state feels it is worth further exploration. The state's assessment of the risk of extinction or persistence is based on a single model of population dynamics, the Ricker model, which is basically a stock recruitment. It looks at the number of recruits produced per spawner. And that model has certain strengths, and it's a valid model, but there are other models, and so we encourage the state to continue to look closely at those other models, as we know that it is doing, with particularly the Coastal Coho TRT, the Technical Recovery Team for NOAA Fisheries, that is applying several other models. And so we think continued inspection and comparison to those other models would make this assessment continue to be robust and even more robust than it stands by its dependence on the RCRA model alone. We are aware that the state has been working very closely with the TRT, and the results are encouraging in comparison with those other models. So this is not an area that we should all be worried about how it's going to turn out necessarily. It's just an area that we need to maintain some close attention. Yes, sir.
Kind of a standard question again that I have, Stan. How many teachers is it going to cost me to use those other models as well? How many teachers do I have to spend teachers to use those other models?
Oh, I think two per model should about do it. But
two per model.
Yes.
And how many models do we want?
Five.
So it's 10 teachers.
No.
Okay.
I realize, Chairman Jensen and committee, I realize you have many things to balance in this. The good news is those additional models don't cost the state of Oregon anything as far as I'm aware. They're being provided by the federal government and NOAA Fisheries scientists. So in this particular case, I don't think it will cost us a single teacher.
Okay. That's good. That's good.
No. And I did not. Actually, when you were asking about teachers, I was thinking how many teachers it might require to help inform you about each of the models. I didn't realize you meant salaries for teachers.
You don't need to.
Representative Barnard. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very pleased to use the teacher unit as a unit of cost, because I think that's an extremely useful model for the legislature today. And I appreciate it.
Representative Barnard, thank you for the compliment. I've been using that for some time now.
Well, I know you have, but it's particularly useful in this session.
Yes. Thank you, Stan.
Thank you, Chairman Jensen. We also have questions about the... we suggest that the coastal Oregon landscape is going to be dynamic and will change in the future. The population is increasing. The questions of where that population will be in coastal Oregon is an enormous question, but there are approaches for dealing with that. We feel that the assessment is somewhat static, in that the projections for the status of salmon for 99 years in the future in the extinction risk analysis was based on the current landscape remaining constant for 99 years. It had changing ocean conditions and changing survival, but the landscape, the current distribution of forests, agricultural areas, urban areas that we see in coastal Oregon were projected to remain fixed for 99 years. We know that with the projected population that that's highly unlikely. It may not change the conclusions about the viability of the stocks as they stand at this moment in time, but we do think that that dynamic landscape change would be important in the development of the conservation plan that the state envisions for coastal coho that it will be preparing in the next few years. So we encourage that as we develop a conservation plan for coastal coho, we look at projections of changing landscape and changing human population, not just changing ocean conditions and changing climate. We felt that the piece...
And I'm mulling that, over a little too. We get to this changing landscape, and I'm concluding that you're introducing changing human populations as part of the landscape sort of thing here. And of course, I recognize if we change, and I assume everybody recognizes that if we change the landscape to the extent that we have changed the landscape for some of what would have been the natural reproduction grounds for salmon, like in the city of Portland, where we put asphalt concrete over it, and if we do this throughout the entire landscape, I mean, clearly we have made the species extinct. I'm not sure, and I do know you have at least kind of a colleague, I think works with EPA out of Oregon State, generally raises this issue as far as salmon and the extinction of salmon, Dr. Lackey, I think, mm-hmm. and and which has led me at times to ask the question, how many people can salmon afford? And there is certainly projections for us as far as growth in the Pacific Northwest that may become a very real issue. And if we've got enough asphalt and concrete, we can't have the other sort of thing. And I don't know where I'm going with this comment, except at least to me, this is abundantly clear in the kind of whole nature of this equation, that the landscape, and we get to here then a political question, and a political question in this case that may be beyond the ability of this body, the state legislature or state government, even to control. Sort of thing that that might require something significantly beyond our capabilities of controlling it, and so I guess I'm just wondering what the utility here is, other than just to point out I don't mean to be demeaning with this, but what seems to me to be the obvious.
Chairman Jensen and committee members, I appreciate what you suggest about the degree of human change and asphalt, and Dr. Lackey's suggestion about how extreme some of these choices are going to be and how difficult. To me, it comes down to the question of, are we going to think about what will happen if we do what we currently do? And so the state, through a variety of means, has developed a whole series of practices and policies, and we have a population that carries those out. So what's going to happen over the next 50 years if we do what we say we're doing, if we carry out our policies? Because they allow for more people, they allow for growth, they allow for cities, they allow for concrete, farms, forestry, all these. So what's going to happen if we do what we think we're doing? And I think it's just reasonable for us to examine that. And we can do it scientifically. We can come up with plausible representations from people who make these decisions or live in this valley and do this work every day or in this state. We can make these projections and make them spatially explicit. We can put them in maps. And we can model what difference it's likely to make for salmon or for wildlife or for water. And we can do that now. And then at the same time, we can also ask people who make these decisions and people who work in the watershed councils in these communities and farmers and foresters and public representatives, we can ask them, well, what's plausible in terms of the Oregon plan? If we really carry out the Oregon plan over the next 50 years so that our kids or our grandkids are going to see it, what difference is it going to make versus if we just keep doing what we're doing? Or what's going to happen if we relax it, if we ease up on some of these protections? What will be the outcome? And just to bound it, now it's not to guarantee that that crystal ball is going to be exact and very clear. It may be a little bit fuzzy, but I think there is the need to ask the question of what is plausible? What's going to happen if we do these things? Because the decisions that you are making today, the decisions that we are making today as a society, is shaping that landscape 50 years from now. So we think science can help, and we think the state, in developing its conservation plan, can start to bound what that future might look like and what the implications would be for salmon and watersheds in a scientific way. We think there are scientific tools to do this. We've done it for the Willamette Basin, and the alternative future scenarios for the Willamette Basin. There's a great website that you can go to called willametteexplorer.info. And you can see this assessment, and it looks from 1850 to the present for the Willamette Basin and from the present to 2050 under different scenarios for the future. And it indicates, interestingly, that habitat conditions in some of these resources, like fish and invertebrates and wildlife, and water availability will continue to decline under our current policies and practices, but the decline will be far less than what we have seen since 1850. But it shows also that plausible restoration activities, restoration practices that the stakeholders felt were plausible, not a bunch of pinhead scientists, but the stakeholders felt were likely, reversed that decline and recovered about a third of what had been lost since 1850, with 2 million more people in the basin. So we think this kind of analysis of futures could help guide the Oregon plan and actually inform the people of Oregon as, are the investments we're making in the Oregon plan, are they worth it? Are they going to pay off? Or, you know, and when we have to balance people and teachers and children and salmon and all these things, how do we make those decisions? And is it really worth it? And we think there are some ways science can help.
Okay.
Long-winded answer to a very short question. I apologize for that.
Perhaps not so short. We'll maybe get back there.
So, actually, at this point, I'd just like to conclude and open the floor for questions. In general, the IMST believes that the assumptions and analysis underpinning the state's co-assessment are valid. We commend the authors for their excellent synthesis of the relevant information and creative approach to their problem, and we appreciate the process and how they involved us from the very inception in knowing what they were doing and providing input. They attended quite a few of our meetings, and in the last several meetings we probed as deeply and carefully as we could into their analysis, and trying to make sure that we could see that this was scientifically credible. And basically we found that the process used was very scientifically valid, and that it was built on an important information base that the state has developed under the Oregon Plan. So I think the state should be proud of the Oregon Plan, proud of its monitoring plan, proud of its actions on changing harvest management and hatchery practices, proud of the efforts to try to work with watershed councils and agencies dealing with our watersheds and their condition. And we think it underscores the need to continue the efforts on the Oregon Plan, because we face this issue in other parts of the state and with many other stocks than just the coastal coho salmon. So this will actually serve as a excellent and strong example of how the state can approach these resource problems. So I welcome any questions for the IMST.
You aren't through.
I could read more. I could go into detail about the Ricker curve and the beta. There, actually, thank you, Representative Jensen, Chairman Jensen. There, in the version that we reviewed, there is a point toward the end of the viability analysis in which they did an analysis of what happens if we change habitat capacity in the Ricker model, this population model for coho. Now, it turns out that when we say the word habitat capacity, I think that means something to the general public, to the lay public. As it was used in that assessment, it was actually not habitat capacity in terms of deep pools, cool or cold water, clean sediments, large wood, things like that. It wasn't that. It was a function, a parameter in an equation that kind of dealt with the ceiling or the upper level of a curve. And that was called habitat capacity. And they found that they could reduce that beta value, that parameter in the equation, by 50 to 80% before they started to see a substantial increase in the risk of extinction. Now, that was, I think that was an accurate representation of the performance of that model of populations, but I would stress that habitat capacity does not convey clearly what was being done, because to most of the public they would think, oh, we can reduce pool habitat or clean high quality habitats by 50 to 80% before we start running into risk of extinction. And that is not what the assessment was trying to say. And so we've encouraged them in the documentation here, we've encouraged them to be more specific about, they were simply changing a parameter in a population model, but they were not changing something that represented the true quality of the habitat, the way that most Oregonians would think about the quality of the habitat. And so we felt that many people could read that and go, wait a minute, why are we doing all these things in forest practices, in agricultural practices, in urban requirements, when we can reduce the habitat by 80% before we start running into risk of extinction? And that's not what this assessment was saying. So we wanted to make sure that wasn't misunderstood.
Representative Barnard. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, you've raised in my mind a series of questions about, not necessarily about this report, but about the conceptualization of the whole area. And I appreciate the answer you gave Chair Jensen a minute ago, because it helped both indicate the optimism with which you obviously approach this area, and also I think suggests to me that the question that I want to ask you, and that's this: how well do we actually understand, and I'll put it a different way, how well do our models actually reflect the reality on the ground and in the water? And a sub-piece of that question is, how much risk can we afford to take that our models are wrong at a crucial time? I hope that I'm trying to fit this in with what you were saying just a moment ago.
Chairman Jensen, Representative Barnard, that's a very well-stated question that we have tried to address in here. On one hand, one answer is that the state's monitoring program right now provides the opportunity to hold up observations of the performance of the fish distributed across coastal Oregon to the predictions of the model, and to continuously be seeing how well our models are performing. And the state is doing that. And we can indicate for various models how closely the predicted output matches the observed responses. And it's encouraging, but quite often for biological data that are highly variable, we are happy if we can explain 60% of the variance, 70% of the variation out there in salmon with our models. Something like that. That would be a good model. In physics, you get to deal with explaining 90%, 99%. In ecology, we tend to be happy with 60 or 70%. So that means there is this question of uncertainty. What about that unexplained portion of the variance?
If I got a 99% explanation, I still have a question of uncertainty.
Yes, 100%. You do. 1%. It's not gone. But that uncertainty is different than if your uncertainty is 33%.
It's 32% different.
Yeah, and most of my decisions in life, if I can, yeah.
I understand, you know, what you're saying, but with very, very few exceptions, there is nothing in science that gets to the point of being an absolute.
Chairman Jensen, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, and as a consequence, if we base our life on science, as we are being in this particular arena, being asked to do, then the appropriate thing, the appropriate question seems to me to be, do we have at our disposal the tools to reverse our positions if we have that 33% uncertainty or whatever it is happens to be the case? I mean, that's the critical, to me, the same way as the probability is 99%. Right. Do we have the ability to, if I'm on that, you know, space shuttle or whatever it happens to be, of course, I've given up the chance when I'm up there of reversing this, but that's also a choice I probably made to, you know, have the thrill, you know. But in public policy, the question is that if it isn't, do we have the ability to move on and to correct or come up with a different approach to it. I'm sorry, I'm editorializing.
No, Chair Jensen and committee, that's exactly right. Science will never be 100% certain. There will always be some uncertainty in any phenomenon that we describe. But in those, and in those decisions, you're exactly right. We have a balance of uncertainty and the risks that we're willing to take and what information we have that would allow us to reverse if we observed that things were not performing the way we thought they were. So in this case, that underscores the value of this assessment in laying out the probabilities, but the importance of the monitoring program to continue to observe the response of the fish, the habitat, the condition of Oregon's watersheds, and if we see that they are performing in a way that isn't what we expected or isn't what we desired, then where do we have the opportunity to make changes? We have, and it differs according to the different things that may be impacting salmon. Harvest, we can turn that knob a little faster. We can change harvest practices a little faster than some of the other components, but it's still, there's a time lag. You change harvest, it's still going to take a little bit of time. Hatchery practices, maybe a little bit longer, but we could still adapt and modify our hatchery practices as we have been over the last 10 years. Habitat conditions, it's not as easy to correct those if we suddenly find out that the trend that we've, the changes we've made, the concrete that we've created, the habitat conditions we've created are not what we desire. It takes longer for habitat to recovery. And we're finding that over and over and over, that habitat responses and habitat restoration do take a lot longer. One of the previous members of the IMST, Wayne Elmore, had a great saying that I loved. He said that when it comes to restoration of habitat, for most Americans, instant gratification isn't fast enough. When we do our restoration projects, we want to walk away feeling that now the habitat's better and the fish are responding. But for many of these things, with riparian conditions, with sediments, with water quality, it literally will take decades to multiple decades before we start seeing the responses. And it's important in the Oregon Plan to recognize just what you said. If we detect a change that isn't what we wanted, it will take differing amounts of time for different responses, and we need to be observing that carefully. So if anything, this assessment points toward the need to continue monitoring coastal coho salmon carefully.
Go ahead. Representative Tomei.
Okay, Mr. Chair, this has nothing to do with the latest speaker, the speaker and your latest contribution to this committee. But I guess I'm still back to your asking the question about how many teachers is this going to cost. And it seems like you're almost posing a Sophie's choice in a way. And I'm real uncomfortable with that, and I'm trying to work it out in my little brain late on a Friday afternoon. And as we look to the future in 50 years, I mean, 50 years ago, I could not have predicted, maybe somebody could have predicted what Oregon was going to look like today. And it's hard for me to picture what it will look like in 50 years. But I guess if there is a job that I think the legislature has, it is to help predict that and protect our state for our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. And it seems to me that the Oregon Plan is one of those things that's on our plate to deal with, to try to protect this resource as well as other natural resources that hopefully will be there for future generations. So I don't want to choose between a teacher and a healthy environment. I want to choose both. So I guess that's my 2 cents for the day.
Representative Tomei, I think probably all of us would like to have both. But it kind of brings me back to Stan's statement, I think, about instant gratification. Is that instant?
Instant.
Yeah. Isn't fast enough. Somehow we have fallen into this trap of thinking somehow we can have everything. And my very first economics professor, you know, defined what is an economic good. Something that doesn't exist in such quantity that everybody can have all of it that they want. And I think we're fooling ourselves and maybe shortchanging our children and our children's children when we try to build policy predicated upon that assumption that we have an infinite ability to deal with. The reality is life is full of making choices. I think as far as what the world would have looked like 50 years, there was some pretty good literature available as early as 1951 about what the Willamette Valley or what the valley would look like from Seattle to Eugene, coming out of the University of Washington, and that demographic study, if you had picked it up and picked any decade in between or any years in between there, you would have found a pretty accurate picture of what it was going to look like. And we're being told some of the same things about the landscape now as far as the Willamette Valley or the coast. And I think Dr. Lackey mentioned months ago in some of his discussions doesn't question that there may not be, that it might not be possible to return to some prehistoric times as far as salmon are concerned. I think his basic premise is whether or not there is the will of the people to make that types of, those types of commitments. And it would take commitments, I think, as I said, that would maybe be beyond the ability of this legislature or any state legislature to, you know, bring about maybe forces more powerful than... I Representative, you're a beautiful lady and you know, a hopeless romantic, I think. And it's one of the, you know, one of the great qualities. But we do have choices to make, and we do that every day. And as we pursue this activity, we do it every day in our other life. Mm-hmm. But we do it especially here as we have gotten that divine revelations about what it is that is supposed to make life better for us here in Oregon. Your point, and I understand your point, I agree, you know, with what you say. I'd like not to have to make those kind of choices. I'd like not to have to make the kind of choices of whether or not we're going to provide the resources we need to provide to the Oregon Health Sciences Center to allow them to develop a technology or to develop a, you know, some part of medicine that will allow us to live out another 100 years, or out to 125, or you know, whatever. But if we do this, and we maybe can do a whole bunch of things about this, but in the process of doing that, we will create for us a whole bunch of new problems, and. And that's why you get paid the big bucks to come down here and make these kind of decisions. I don't know. Representative Barnes.
I'd make a comment that maybe brings us back a little bit closer to the report. I wanted to just reiterate that I really appreciate the sense of optimism that you've approached this task with, and also note that I do not believe there have been any civilizations in the Earth's past that have succeeded in preserving forests and streams and basic habitat. I believe that all of them have gone to the stage at some point at which they have destroyed the lands in which they live. The land of milk and honey in the Bible turned into a desert in the intermediate period, and is in many ways just coming back now with the application of some pretty astounding methods. China lost nearly all of its forests over the last 5,000 years and is just now beginning to restore some of what it has lost. We in Oregon and on the west coast of the United States have a great opportunity in that we might be the first place where civilization has existed past the hunter-gatherer stage, where we might actually pull it off and not destroy our habitat in the process of living here. And I appreciate the optimism that I hear in your report today.
I appreciate the comments, Representative Barnhart. I think for point of reference with that, though, you're talking about the forest sort of thing. We have gone beyond where we were. And so there's nothing in this kind of magical thing of what was in the past. At least I understand from what the foresters tell me, we have more standing board feet of lumber in the state of Oregon today than we did when Lewis and Clark came down the Columbia River, in spite of what we hear somewhat to the contrary on that. And, of course, that has come about because of a pretty much an adaptive management practices.
That's really very illustrative of my point.
And I think some of that management practice has only come about because we've got chainsaws that we can go out and cut trees down so that we can replenish them with young trees to take their place for future generations, whereas contrasted to, but we'll get into a whole different discussion there.
Chairman Jensen.
Yes.
Chairman Jensen and the committee, just a brief response. It makes any ecologist uncomfortable to be overly optimistic, and so I guess I need to make sure that I stress that the assessment of coho, coastal coho as I read it, is not glowing and overly optimistic in saying that these are robust and healthy populations, and as Chairman Jensen suggests, we have more than we know what to do with. It indicates that they recently were at historical lows and at a very, very critical point, that many of the stocks did make it through that very low period. Some local stocks were extirpated during the recent history, and that they are improving at this point in time, and that this assessment concludes that they meet the minimum criteria for viability, but they are not overly abundant or extremely healthy or robust at this time. It does not make that conclusion. It doesn't venture into that any one way or the other. So I would say that the optimism is that if people do care about their resources and do care about the future, we can make some choices that will lead to a better and more desirable future with greater hope for those resources. And for that, I am very optimistic. But I, at the same time, recognize that many of our landscapes and streams and rivers and resources are not in the condition that we would really want them to be.
Interesting. It kind of brings up an interesting, I think, point. I believe they're, and I'm making kind of a quantum leap here, and my apologies for that. But I believe in the biological sciences, there's some studies that with mice, as far as population were concerned, that if you have too many mice in a particular environment, they will go extinct. That you reach a point beyond which they are incapable of reproducing themselves, type of thing. The state of South Dakota, back in my younger years, used to have tens of thousands of pheasants everywhere you looked, and it was easy to be a good hunter because all you had to do was go out and walk through the field and shoot, and something was going to fall. The population, you know, was in fact so great that it began to go down. Mm-hmm. And only when the state finally realized, and this was before some of the things we're doing now, only when they began to realize that you're going to have to kill off some of the hens, did they finally bring that population back, started to bring it back where it's a viable population again. And I understand there are all sorts of other variables that go into to any survival of any population. But it seemed to me, if I recall the presentation correctly, one of the interesting things that we found out, the department found out of the study, was that put this in the other terminology, the less fish you had, the higher the level of reproductivity. We probably are dealing here with a phenomenon that until the conclusion is reached hasn't been part of the radar screen. Maybe it has been on some of the radar screens, but I found this to be an interesting observation, which seems to me to fit some other observation, one of which I mentioned is a scientific observation, the other is my just kind of personal observations of another thing.
Chairman Jensen and committee, that raises a very important point that we address in our detailed comments. I think there's a figure in the viability assessment, I think it's figure 3, that graphs out the relationship that you just suggested in productivity, the young or replacements, the recruits per spawner versus the abundance of spawners. And so you see very high recruits per spawner at low spawning densities and that decreasing sharply and then flattening out at high spawner densities. And the state pointed out that this increase in productivity at low abundances provided some measure to resist or avoid extinction. Didn't state it exactly that way, but inherently in that there's an increase in productivity at low densities. We have to be very careful about looking at that relationship, because to some degree it simply reflects what happens when you graph the production per spawner versus the abundance of spawners. When you're at very low numbers of spawners, even though you may be producing four times as many spawners, or recruits, you still have a very low number. The recruits per spawner is large, your productivity is large, but you have a low number of spawners. So the outcome of that is a low number of recruits. It doesn't mean that you have a lot of fish. And so it's just like, if you have a lot of material to work with and you start building something, the amount that you produce is per material that you have is pretty low. You've got lots of material, but as you start getting less and less, you still try to keep producing as much. The amount that you produce per material item is going to go up. You're making do with less and less and less, but you're not making more. You can still have a low production, a low output, and that's what we're facing with the salmon. Just because their productivity goes up at low numbers doesn't mean their numbers are up and they're at risk of extinction. So we need to be cautious about how that curve is interpreted. And part of it, Chairman Jensen will appreciate from a mathematical point of view, is simply a matter of of graphics. If you take a Y value on your graph and it's recruits per spawner, and then you plot it against spawners, you will get inherently get that shape of the curve to a large degree. And so it doesn't mean that the populations will always resist extinction. It does mean that their productivity per spawner will go up at low numbers, but the bottom line there is you still have low numbers. And so the risk of extinction is still there. So we kind of warn about, don't get overly encouraged by the shape of that curve.
Yeah.
It still means you're down in a low numbers game.
Mm-hmm.
The state actually, I would give them credit in their assessment, they took conservative measures of how many fish it took to consider the population there to be viable, or conversely, how few it took to be considered extinct. And so they used a relatively high number so that their estimates were conservative. And so they've taken conservative approaches in all of this. One other thing that I would like to encourage you to recognize and encourage your colleagues in the legislature to recognize and perhaps go see is, in preparing the assessment, the state prepared a number of other documents that are on their website for the assessment and for the Oregon plan. Those documents were reviews of what we know right now about harvest, about hatcheries, what we know about habitat and the condition of Oregon's habitat. That document alone is one of the most important scientific assessments that I've seen in the last decade. And so there are a number of, and the different agencies, water quantity, water quality, the different state agencies responsible under the Oregon Plan did assessments. And those documents are there, and they're kind of hidden or masked by this viability assessment, by this status assessment. But make sure that you look deeper and recognize the state has produced some very important reviews of where we really stand right now based on information and evidence, not just what is our hope, what is our gut feeling, what is our bias. It's they took the data that were available for the state, for coastal Oregon, and did an assessment. And I think that was a notable accomplishment that somehow gets quickly overlooked and probably doesn't get read as carefully as it should.
Okay. Other? I see Mr. Bowles is here. Would you be kind enough to tell us your big disappointments in this?
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, I'm Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And don't have a prepared statement today. We had the pleasure of rolling out some of our results to the committee. I think that was last week, wasn't it? And so you've had a good opportunity to see what we've been up to for the past year. I would just like to mention, from my personal standpoint, not speaking for the state necessarily on this, but I am very impressed with, given the time that the IMST was provided on this, and Stan mentioned that they had been working iteratively throughout the past year with us, but we basically gave them our documents kind of rolled out just before the Christmas break and then a ways after that break. And in a short amount of time, they have been able to go through and digest the nuggets out of 700-plus pages, all our hidden little things, and were able, I think, to do a very constructive and thoughtful analysis of that. And so I think the IMST really deserves a lot of credit for the willingness to take that on in that short time frame and the recognition that they had to take a pretty broad brush approach to it. The other point I would make is that I think the role of the IMST in helping the state move forward on a full-blown conservation plan, as we talked to this committee about earlier, is going to be very vital, not only to perhaps help with some of the analytical tools, but also maybe getting the state's hands around some of these futuring issues a little bit better, because this conservation plan will take us beyond minimum viability to contemplating how we may address future scenarios through, you know, policy making and decision making. And it's always good to have an analytical way of characterizing that, and so that support will be helpful.
Questions for Mr. Bull? Well, thank you. I appreciate your extemporaneous, no prepared, no thought. I'm sure been a lot of thought to go into everything on this. One of the things, in conclusions, I think of my things on this stand, one of the criticisms I heard, the shortcomings, if that's the right terminology, was there maybe was less attention paid to some of the alternatives or some of the issues. Probably go back and be more specific. As you were going through the technical comments, you're talking about a more balanced approach, and assuming as we were talking about that that it might have been less attention paid to maybe the negative than might have been. I hope you will understand and won't take offense by my statement that's coming now, but that would have been my comment in relationship to the IMST's water temperature report. Not that I disagree necessarily with the science of the report, but the science of the contrary, which there is some, while I'm sure you took it into consideration, was not reflected in the report. So that's kind of a, if you want to shoot me down on that, well, be my guest.
Chairman Jensen and committee members, since this is probably going to be my last opportunity to appear before the Water Committee, and I have enjoyed our conversations over the last several years, my term on the IMST ends the end of June, so it's unlikely that I'll be back here talking to you. I will take advantage of this opportunity and my one last chance to talk to you today. To first of all say that I'm glad to hear that you largely agree with the overall document and the science, and I would infer from that the recommendations or conclusions, that perhaps the balance wasn't there in treating some of the information that was contradictory to other information. I feel that we did a major review of the information on temperature, and there is a large body of information out there that we synthesized, and I felt that by far and away the weight of the evidence, the strong weight of the evidence, was consistent with our conclusions in the temperature report. And to be honest, as a scientist and an IMST member, I fully stand behind our report, and I have looked for conclusions that would be incorrect, recommendations that we would no longer support. I've taken it back to the IMST after our conversations and said, okay, if we're wrong, we need to stand up. As a matter of fact, on a harvest management report, once we did stand up and say one of our conclusions was incorrect, and we sent in a letter with noting that mistake. I still stand behind the temperature report and feel that it is a strong scientific document, and I welcome the state to have it reviewed by anyone. I think it would get an excellent review, and I apologize to any scientist or person that we have misrepresented in that report, and it certainly was not the intent of the IMST. But I do think that when it comes to temperature, the state has made major advances in how it looks at stream temperature, I think we have a much better understanding of the factors that people change that can potentially, and I say potentially, influence stream temperature, things including shade, but also water quantity, the dimensions of the channel, the subsurface exchange. We held workshops with people on both sides of the issue, and all those things came forward each time, and people signed off on them. So I think that's good guidance for the state. There are certain things we can do to manage for stream temperatures to make Oregon what we want it to be within the realms of what is physically possible and what is biologically possible. And I hope the IMST's temperature report shed some light on that and can be useful in that decision making. And if it distracted things, I do apologize, and we would like to know what those things are so that we could correct them, because we don't want any report to stand out there that's incorrect.
Thank you. You say you don't go off till June?
End of June.
The probability is we will still be in session until by the time you go off, and there's a lot of time between now and the end of June for us to find some reason to bring you back here. So,
Chairman Jensen, I always enjoy it, and I welcome it at any time. And it would give me one chance to encourage the committee members, anything you can do to help in the replacement process to make sure that the IMST is always strong and fully staffed, the IMST will appreciate.
Thank you. We're working on that. If there's no other comments, and don't forget.
You did.
Thank you. I'm about to make an announcement, and apparently I've already done that, so I'll not do that then. Anything else for the good of the order, Cindy?
No, Mr. Chair. Everybody have a good weekend.
Everybody have a good weekend. Thank you. Thank you, Stan, and it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Ed. We're